This is the sound of turning ideas into software. This is the sound of engineering and passion. Work. Work more. Work harder. Experiment. Build. Break. And build again. Write code. Improve it. Job done. Celebrate. Insurance, finance, retail, defense, robotics, energy. Amethix.
Welcome back to another episode of Data Science at Home podcast. I'm Francesco, podcasting from the usual office of Amethix Technologies based in Belgium. Today, I want to speak about special chips. The chips that are executing all the things that we know about AI, from ChatGPT to the large language models to all the other neural networks that we are running on our machines or in the cloud. Well, there is someone that is actually executing that, and or something that is actually executing that, and that something is, of course, your chip. So there has been and still very active research when it comes to designing chips that are specialized for certain domains, and of course, AI is one of those domains for which chip makers have been spending an enormous amount of resources and time and effort in order to optimize or improve as much as they could the performance of these chips that are executing special applications like indeed neural networks. So in this episode, I would like to give kind of a general knowledge about what is an AI chip, how does it work, why it is important, and of course, what should we be expecting in the next few years from this field. So the idea of specializing or designing chips that are specialized for a particular sector is not new, of course. We have seen this in the history of computing for many special applications, especially from military and defense, but also healthcare, in which we have always had special devices that are optimized to execute one particular task. So this is not what we are usually referring to as general purpose computing, which is the computers that we find in the shops and we purchase every year, probably. So there is also, for example, in gaming, that's also another special domain for which special chips have to be designed for that task. And here I can think of all the consoles that we know, from Sony PlayStation to Microsoft Xbox and many others out there, that are indeed, these are devices that have particular chips specifically designed to run, of course, video games. So before speaking about AI chips and what's going on in that market and what we should be expecting, I think we should all know about semiconductors and transistors. What are these things? Because these are basically the core concepts that one has to understand before moving on. So what is a semiconductor? Semiconductor is a special material with some kind of electrical conductivity. That's why it's called a semiconductor. And it's not working as a conductor, but as a semiconductor, because it can switch between being conductive and insulative in different circumstances. So a semiconductor can be conductive and not conductive under certain constraints, right? While a conductor cannot have that flexibility. So if you take copper, for example, that's a conductor, or gold, usually. These are special conductors that cannot really choose not to be conductive anymore. Well, a semiconductor has this kind of special power. The other concept is the concept of transistor. And when I first, when the concept of transistor was first explained to me many years ago at university, I found it quite weird, because to say the least, because it's a device that can, switch between an on and off state, representing one and zero. You know, we all know the binary system of computing, and essentially transistors, generally speaking, include an insulator, usually referred to as oxide, between a gate and a semiconductor channel, which is usually silicon, and the gate is usually the conductive metal or a conductive material. And so essentially what happens is that the semiconductor channel connects a source and a drain. And so what happens is that when a voltage, for example, an electric field is applied to the gate, the channel is put in an on state so that the current can flow between the source and the drain. Well, when the voltage is not applied, the channel is put in an off state such that the current cannot flow between the source and the drain, and so you have an off transistor. So what the transistor does essentially is converting voltages or a low level voltage and a high level voltage into on and off, right? And essentially on and off means one and zero, which we all know are, you know, the core of any computing system out there, at least binary compute. These transistors, as you, many of you know probably, are the basic component, are the number one ingredient of any chip that you purchase out there. From the general purpose chips to the specialized chips, they're all made of transistors. The difference is how these transistors are connected with each other and, of course, how many of these transistors are present on a single chip. And today we are speaking about several billion of these transistors on a single chip, which makes it amazing because the level of complexity that you can reach with, let's say, 10, 20 billion transistors is incredible. Now, of course, all these transistors into one chip, you know, they increase the so-called density of the chip and also use energy, more or less energy. So there are, you know, there is no, so one can, you know, it's tempted to increase the number of transistors indefinitely, you know, in a naive way. But of course, there are limitations that there are limits that you immediately hit. For example, you cannot have a chip with a certain density, or you would have, or you would reach, for example, very high temperatures or very high power consumptions, for which that chip becomes probably inefficient and definitely not useful. Now, what we have observed in, especially in the last 20 years, and more particularly in the last 10 years with the advent of AI technology, but of course, this is a trend that is going on since the 60s and 70s for sure, is that chip manufacturers have tried to produce, and well, design first and then produce more and more efficient chips. And when AI, and with the advent of AI technology, as a concept, and so in particular with the advent of neural networks, which is a very specific algorithm to execute on a chip, we have seen much more interest in you know, from the chip makers into producing specialized chips only for neural networks. Of course, we have seen this trend already happening with video games, which is also another particular algorithm or family of algorithms that you can run on your machine. And we have seen, for example, the advent of GPUs, so-called graphic processing units, that have been sold together with the CPU, which is the central processing unit, that is more designed towards general purpose processing, and so general purpose compute. So when we speak about AI chips, we are speaking about several families of chips, in fact. It's not just one. So, of course, we all know the GPU, NVIDIA and Radeon and all the things that we buy to play video games. At least that's what I do. But essentially, there are many more families, and in particular, two more specifically designed for AI, which is ASICs and FPGA. So FPGA is something very fascinating concept. FPGA stands for Field Programmable Gate Arrays, while ASIC stands for Application Specific Integrated Circuits. And the acronyms should already tell you what they are, because with an FPGA, you essentially can, you know, the field programmable gate. So it means that you can program your chip. In fact, you can, let's say, decide and define the connections of how the transistors are connected internally for your particular application. Okay, so you literally burn, indeed it's called like that in the jargon, you burn FPGA. That means you set up the internal wiring of how the submodules of this chip will be connected for your particular application. And when you change the application, in fact, when you change the algorithm that that particular chip or FPGA will execute, well, you just reprogram and you optimize your design, the design of the chip, so that it will better be accommodating that new algorithm. So as you can see, FPGA are super powerful because imagine, it's not exactly like this, but imagine you could design your own CPU, your own chip at your own will for any algorithm, more or less any algorithm. I remember at university, we were playing with, building a chip or designing a chip that would implement the decoding and decoding of MP3s or Ogg Vorbis, that was another format, open source format for playing music and compress, pretty much similar to MP3. MPEG layer 3. And the idea there was like, okay, I'm going to design this algorithm. It works like this. Now, which chip would execute this algorithm in the most optimized way? And we used FPGAs that we wired accordingly. So we had so-called EDA, which is, I will speak about that later. It's essentially computer-aided design, CAD, that allow you to design the chip on paper or on screen first and then burn it. And burn it means finalizing your design into the chip so that the chip could run that particular algorithm the fastest possible way or in the most efficient possible way, for example, using least electric power and so on and so forth. The other family of circuits is ASICs, which stands for application-specific integrated circuits. And these are, less flexible than FPGA, but they can be extremely fast and extremely optimized. So usually ASICs are, designed for a particular algorithm, and they will keep executing that algorithm until, you just change everything and you start from scratch. So that's why they're not as flexible as an FPGA, but they can be much, much faster. Now, the problem of ASICs is that they would not have, an interesting market life in the sense that when something changes at the software level, it's almost impossible to maintain the same or to guarantee the same level of optimization on the chip with an ASIC because ASIC, you cannot reprogram them. They just die. They just like that until the rest of their life. Now, there are several ways, of course, to increase the efficiency of an AI chip, and I'll try to explore some of them in this episode. We will speak about parallel compute. We will speak about speeding up memory access. Just give me some time because this is a massive topic, super nice, very fascinating. Also, a lot of skills are involved. There is a material science, there is electronics, there is computer science. A lot of skills are required in order to tackle this particular problem. So why AI chips are necessary for AI? Well, we all know that AI chips are usually tens or even thousands of times faster and more efficient than CPUs. And even if you purchase probably the latest or the top you can get now from NVIDIA cards, graphic cards, you will notice an improvement, a dramatic improvement with respect to the chips of a few years ago, even less than two. And this is because, of course, these chips are designed particularly for special games or for special algorithms like, as I said, deep neural networks. If you make a comparison with the good old CPU, or I would say the poor CPU, usually you will find, it's even more than dramatic, the difference. If you have trained a neural network on CPU, you can do this by taking, for example, PyTorch library, if you're using Python, and decide to train a neural network on CPU. And then if you are lucky enough to have a GPU at home, or you can just rent one from the cloud, you can run the same algorithm using PyTorch, you just enable, there are ways to do that very, you know, one single line of code, in which you are telling PyTorch, hey, this computation, please run it on the GPU, because look, surprise, I have a GPU now. So if exactly the same algorithm is run on the GPU, by algorithm, I mean a neural network, you will see probably 10, 20, sometimes even 100 times faster in during training. So you would train a network in 1 hour when that network could be trained usually in hundreds of hours on a single CPU. So that's how important AI chips are for AI. The problem is that according to Moore's law, that tells us about the number of transistors in a chip doubling about every 2 years, apparently this is kind of not happening anymore. And so it means that we are kind of reaching a limit that Moore didn't really predict, which makes sense because Moore is a law of many, many years ago, from the 60s, in fact. And of course, you know, it was quite hard back in the days to think where we would have been or where we are today. When it comes to CPU speed, that's also something that we have improved a lot. Well, researchers and manufacturers. To the point that now we are also reaching another limit there. And all this means that we have to find something else in order to, keep enjoying this or keep experiencing this constant improvement. And the problem of all this, of course, can be conducted back to the transistor, because as I said, the transistor is the number one ingredient of your GPU, CPU, hard disk, SSD, whatever. They are all based on transistors. And so as transistors have shrunk to sizes that are a few atoms thick, they are actually approaching a fundamental lower limit on size. So that's kind of the lower bound that we can physically reach, at least with this material. Or we find new materials that have different properties, or if we want to keep using the same material we are using now, like silicon, for example, and of course I don't get into the details, I personally don't even have the right background to speak about what material exactly our manufacturer is using, but there are, you know, when you use a certain type of material, you are signing a contract with that material. That is, you cannot break the properties of that, the low-level properties of that material. And so you cannot go below certain, for example, sizes. Remember, we are dealing now with 5-nanometer technology. And if you want to go beyond the 3-nanometer challenge, apparently that would not be possible with this material. So we need to find new materials. Or we can experience the same constant improvement on chip by looking at something else, and not just the chip itself, but looking at whatever happens around the chip. And what is happening around the chip is so-called parallelism. So more transistors could theoretically enable a chip to include, you know, many more circuits to perform larger and larger numbers of calculations in parallel. And so the idea here is that if you want to experience a constant speed up, this speed up should come from parallelism and not just by increasing the number of transistors. Because as we said, this can be possible until a certain limit, after which it no longer makes sense to stuff transistors on the same chip. What makes sense, and that's what manufacturers have in fact already noticed, is that major speedups can come from parallelism, and parallelism in turn can be performed by redesigning chip in a way that, of course, they can compute things at the same time, so that we can have on the same chip a parallel computation going on, and also at the same time limiting or minimizing the number of so-called serial computations, which are the computations that have to be performed after another one. So a typical serial computation cannot start if another serial computation hasn't been completed before. And this is where you're kind of stuck, because if you increase the number of serial computations, you know, you will not experience, for example, the multi cores that you have on your desk, because, well, serial computations. Now, when it comes to deep learning, of course, we all know that the typical design of a deep learning algorithm is composed of two essential steps. One is training, and the other is inference. So during training, we all know what happens, you know, from an algorithm perspective, stochastic gradient descent and loss minimization, all the stuff that we have discussed on this show many, many times. During training, from a low-level perspective, one wants to experience so-called data parallelism. While in inference, often this doesn't happen. So what is data parallelism? Data parallelism means that you can have many pieces of data in parallel that are processed in parallel. And that's something that indeed can be done, and usually is done, even from your GPU, by your GPU, that, you know, batches your relatively large input training data and operates on each batch in parallel. And why is that possible? It's because the operations that can be performed, that are performed on the single batch, do not depend on anything else. And so independent operations means that they are highly parallelizable. That's the best you can get from an algorithm, you know, having to repeat computation, exactly the same computation, over and over again on different data. And this means that I can just chunk my data and give it to different modules, which will in parallel perform the computation without interdependency. But there is the second step, which is inference. In inference, you no longer have, or you might not have, this full data parallelism. And so when we think about AI chips, we have to think about, okay, AI chips to optimize what part of the computation? Do you want to optimize it in during training, or do you want to optimize it during inference? Because this ideally might be two completely different chips. And so that's the where the challenge comes with AI. You cannot usually accommodate the requirements and the needs of the researcher who wants to train as fast as possible, because they need to iterate over their algorithm as quickly as possible. Remember, they have research projects, and they have to, you know, this is a not exact science. This is a kind of a trial and error procedure, right? Changing the topology of a network, of a neural network, hundreds or thousands or millions of times if you have automated tools, and try to explore, for example, what is the topology that better performs that particular task. So the type of optimization that, let's say, the AI researcher would ask for is probably not the same optimization that a researcher who does only inference is asking for. Because, for example, for inference, you would just want to have the fastest possible multiplications when it comes to neural networks, that is the multiplication of the input data to the weight matrix and all the matrices of the inner layers until the output. Think about an autonomous vehicle that, of course, has to make a prediction sub-millisecond, because otherwise the car can crash. Now, generally speaking, inference chips require less research breakthrough than training chips, because they require optimization for fewer computations than training chips. And again, this is kind of a general rule, even though it's not really a rule. Now, ASICs require fewer research breakthrough than GPUs and FPGAs, because ASICs are narrowly optimized for specific algorithms. Design engineers consider far fewer variables. So they don't want to build or design something that is like as general as possible, you know, because the ASIC is very optimized for specific algorithms. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that designing an ASIC is kind of easier, let's say, if I can say that, with respect to designing a GPU or an FPGA, because the ASIC has to accommodate only that task and that task only. Now, when it comes to designing a circuit meant for only one calculation, of course, an engineer can translate the calculation into a circuit that is optimized for that calculation. And that's usually what designers do with computer-aided design. It's a special software that allows you to design circuits. Another form of optimization goes under the name of low-precision computing. And we have discussed this a couple of times on this show when we spoke about, for example, quantization methods for neural networks. So low-precision computing essentially sacrifices numerical accuracy for speed and efficiency. And it's based on one very simple observation. That is, if you don't need extreme accuracy in your calculation, it means that I can utilize much less transistors for that particular computation. And so you can think of, if you have an 8-bit chip, the number of possible or 8-bit data or variable, the number of possible values of that 8-bit variable is, of course, 256. But if you have a 16-bit chip, it means that the single value can be represented in, let's say, 536,000 different values. But if you have a 32-bit chip, it means that you can represent 4.3 billion values. And if you have a 64-bit, of course, you can represent 18 quintillion, 1.8 times 10 to the power of 19, right? Potential values. So this means that higher bit data types can represent a wider range of numbers, and of course a larger set of integers or a larger set of floating point numbers, and so on and so forth, which means that the computation can be much more precise. Now, if you are shooting a rocket that requires calculations at a very high precision, of course you want to use 64, 128, probably even higher machines. So 256-bit special processors in military and defense are not an exception, in fact, are quite the rule. But if you're running, for example, a neural network for a task that is a probabilistic method for which 95% and 94.9% does make a big difference for the task at hand, or even less, like 90% and 80% probability of something does make a big difference for your particular use case, probably you would like to, sacrifice a bit the accuracy and reduce, therefore, the number of bits for each single computation, which means reducing, of course, the number of transistors that will perform that computation for you. And so by doing this, so-called low-precision computing, you can save energy, you can save space, or you can just utilize those transistors for something else. Another form of optimization is memory optimization. Memory optimization is also very important because now AI chips include sufficient memory to store even the entire AI algorithm on chip. And this is essential because the alternative to this is using an off-chip memory and, of course, connecting to the off-chip memory, communicating and sharing data, transfer data back and forth from the chip that is performing the compute to the memory that is storing the values, right? Or storing the algorithm. So there is this communication that must happen between the chip and the off-chip memory. And that not only requires time, but also requires energy. And because you have a channel that you have, or a bus, usually if you use a von Neumann architecture, that you need to keep busy with bits and bytes in order to share data from the memory to the chip and the other way around. Now, this means that you need energy. This means that you are dissipating heat and all the consequences of that. Usually, AI chips have, as I said, a sufficient amount of memory on chip, so you can skip that communication with off-chip memory. Last but not least, domain-specific languages, or so-called DSLs. We have seen a lot of Python recently in AI, which is extremely wrong. Now, Python is good for research, but it's definitely not good for production. We all know this, you know this, and if you don't, just do it. Because programming languages that are not optimized for that particular task should not be used, period. That's why C will never die, in my opinion, and probably new languages like Rust will eventually take over C from another perspective for more safety and all the other properties of that language. But what I mean is that low-level languages are the language of AI, should be the languages of AI. I'm not the first who says this. I think Elon Musk said that, even though I don't like that guy much. But sometimes he says things that make sense. Of course, as I mentioned before, there are also libraries like PyTorch, and these are, you know, code libraries that are written in low-level languages, I think C and C++ for PyTorch, but they have only bindings to Python, which means that one can use Python, but behind the curtain, in fact, they are calling a pre-compiled C or Rust compiled version of the application, and I'm just using Python to, you know, call that piece of code, machine code, in fact. Now, of course, this episode could never be exhaustive when it comes to describing AI chips and what happens at the very low level of artificial intelligence, which is indeed chip maker stuff. But I hope I gave you a very brief introduction to what is running in your box there that is called computer. Thank you so much for listening. I'll speak with you next time.
You've been listening to Data Science at Home podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Podbean to get new fresh episodes. For more, please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or visit our website at datascienceathome.com.